In a world where points depend on hinges,
there are hinge points inside us all.
History on a segue.
It's overdetermined.
We are the points that our hinges have been seeking.
What this podcast asks is, what if?
Agriculture. Fail or epic win?
What if it was Johnny Bango Pit?
What if the Ottomans had AK-47?
Maybe climate change was a good idea.
What if the Ottomans had lightsabers?
What if the buffalo killed us?
What if Santa Claus was real, like an actual guy who gave presents every year? This is Hinge Points.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Hinge Points. I'm Danny Bessner, normally from the American Prestige podcast, here as always with Matt Chrisman. And we are very excited to welcome to the podcast today one of the great podcasters of all time. That is Everett Rummage from The Age of Napoleon. Everett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this episode's going to be a little different than the other ones. It's going to be kind of a lightning round of Napoleon hinge points and alternative histories. But before we get into that, Everett, could you just maybe explain why Napoleon is such an important historical figure? A little bit of a ridiculous question, but let our audience know why we need to know everything about Napoleon.
Okay. So beyond the obvious that, you know, he's probably one of the greatest generals in history, almost certainly the greatest of the modern era. But beyond that, you know, his greater significance, Hegel famously called him history on horseback. You know, so what he meant by that was that Napoleon was an agent of change. Basically, wherever his armies went, he brought new modern ideas about law, about government, about administration with him. And that he spread, you know, the what was left of the French Revolution to the rest of Europe beyond France's borders. He also, you know, he wiped away the old order. So even though he ultimately failed in his bid to, you know, become kind of a universal ruler of Europe, he did sort of wipe away the old world, wipe the slate clean for a period of incredible change in the 19th century. So, you know, you can see him as a guy, you know, as the usher with the big shepherd's thing, pulling someone off, you know, pulling feudalism off the stage so that, you know, modernity, you know, real true modernity can come out and say its piece on the stage.
Perfect. So he's a very important person. Matt, do you want to add anything to why you think Napoleon's such a central figure?
Well, obviously, for all the reasons Everett elucidated, just the personal, you know, set of assets he had and the moment that he lived during allowed him to achieve the greatness that we remember him for, largely by embodying the spirit of the age, you know, understanding the way things were moving and tacking with the wind, basically. You know, that's how he goes from being an idealistic young Jacobin to the ender of the revolution, because he recognizes where the greater forces are flowing and makes it his mission to be there, you know, to stay in the game. But, you know, if that's true, then when we see him fall, we're maybe seeing, you know, the limits of his ability to recognize the moment. But in his career, and we're going to talk about it in this episode, there are these pivotal moments, these hinge points, as we like to call them, where there is this sort of thinning between the possible, you know, courses of history, and where a decision being made differently, or a series of decisions all contingently made, arrived at differently, sees him no longer, you know, riding the wave of history as we understand it, but building an alternative future to the one that we ended up with.
And I think this brings us naturally to our first hinge point, which is a really interesting one that Matt and I have been talking about for a bit. And Everett, we'd love to get your take on this, obviously. And what would have happened if Napoleon allies himself with Toussaint Louverture? Maybe you could let people know who Toussaint was and why he was important and how he does or doesn't relate to Napoleon before we play out this hinge point.
Sure. So Very briefly, at the outbreak of the French Revolution, Haiti, or as it was called at the time, Saint-Domingue, is probably the most profitable, mile for mile, probably the most profitable colony in the world. It's a huge proportion of the French economy is just devoted to commerce with Saint-Domingue. But the revolution sort of shatters the social order on Saint-Domingue, just as it did in France. And just as it happened in France, a civil war breaks out. Although it's odd because it has it has sort of the ideology of the revolution tied to it, but it's in this totally different context of a colonial slaveholding society where 90% of the people are enslaved blacks. And Toussaint Louverture, as the black slaves revolt to reclaim their freedom, Toussaint Louverture quickly emerges as the paramount leader among the different, although far from the only one, but he's, quickly recognized as the paramount leader among the rebel slaves. He very wisely sees that there is an opening for an alliance with France, the colonial power that his people had risen up against. Because of the ideology of the revolution, the more radical figures coming to the fore in France, that creates an opening. And it seems sort of strange, but these former enemies are able to form a really strong working alliance that ultimately results in the victory of the Republican / rebel slave side in this civil war. Toussaint Louverture, the country is horribly devastated. Beyond what we could probably imagine, unless you're from like Syria. But Toussaint Louverture emerges as the leader of this new state, which has a very shaky but real devotion to kind of racial pluralism and sort of a free Republican ideology. But the country's in horrible chaos. The devastation from the Civil War is just horrific. And Toussaint Louverture decides the only way he can really impose order is to impose a very authoritarian constitution with himself as governor for life, with a huge amount of autonomy from France. And this is a very rare instance in history where you have a decision of one person deciding the destiny of millions, because Napoleon writes a letter to Toussaint, accepting him as governor, accepting the constitution, and sort of opening the door to future collaboration. But he never sends that letter. It goes back, it never goes into the outbox. And instead, he decides to side with the planters, to turn against Toussaint Louverture, and send an army to Haiti to reimpose white supremacy. That army is defeated in a bloody and horrific war. And, the rest is history. Haiti becomes independent, but is ruined and never really recovers, is an international pariah for about a century. And it's a very tragic end to a story that had a lot of very hopeful elements to it.
But in our world, Everett, let me tell you this, Napoleon does send that letter. And then let's go from there. So let's imagine Napoleon sends that letter. Matt, what do you see happening there?
It opens up this vast array of possibilities, because the reason that Napoleon is fixated on reasserting control of Haiti is because he sees it as the springboard for his attempt to turn the Caribbean into a French zone, to sort of make up for the fact that the British had completely closed off the Mediterranean by that point. And the United States at that point, had not yet acquired the Louisiana Purchase, which is only a consequence of the failure of the Haiti invasion that Napoleon orders, the possibility of a French invasion of the United States, its soft underbelly in its very underpopulated southern reaches. It gives, because when you see what actually happened when Napoleon was confined to a European-based theater of operations, he couldn't overcome that final element of British naval supremacy. But here, you could establish a French military power on the American continent and compete for resources and power and population there instead of in, you know, Russia, which we've already had to end up doing it.
There's also a possibility, which is, and this is something I would really take with a grain of salt, because it's something, you know, that was said after the fact. It's a very romantic notion, and romantic notions often get, you know, go to the wayside when they meet the, you know, when the rubber meets the road, so to speak. But someone asked this question to Toussaint Louverture's son, and he said that his father's dream had always been, once Haiti was secured and peace was established, to lead an army to West Africa to attack the slave factories and to destroy the slave trade. And, you know, again, very fanciful notion, very romantic. But if it had happened, the whole world economy of that, you know, that mid-19th century period, slavery in the New World was a huge component, you know, of the that Caribbean sugar economy, which was a huge driver of European capitalism. So if all of a sudden someone had come along and kicked out, you know, the main support pillar of that whole sector of the world economy, that opens up a, you know, a whole other Pandora's box of possibilities, you know, far beyond Louisiana and Haiti and the Caribbean.
So that's really interesting. So let's take that as our starting point. Napoleon and Toussaint make an alliance. So this would change a number of things. One, you now have like a solid French-Haitian zone, a transatlantic relationship between Republican France and Republican Haiti in the Caribbean and in Western Europe. What happens then? So let's say they go into West Africa and they actually wind up impeding the slave trade 50 years before it is formally, 60 years before it's formally ended in the United States, 80 years before it's formally ended in Brazil. What specific effects would that have on international capitalism? And then another question that I have for you guys is, what does an alliance like that do in terms of Florida, which at that point is very open? France is obviously premised based in Louisiana, but could you see a southeastern United States that becomes part of a French zone of influence? So you would have basically four bases, one in France, one in the Caribbean, one in West Africa, one in the southeastern United States. What would happen then to international capitalism, and how would international capitalism's history look different?
Well, I mean, obviously that gives the French kind of one really key ingredient to, you know, capitalist development, which is the massive amounts of capital that are generated from you know, these colonial economies. And if you know, at that time, the kind of the future industrial heartland of Europe is under French domination, the Rhineland, Belgium, and so you could see how that could, you know, that system could have produced you know, a real, you know, France really lagged behind in industrialism in the 19th century in our universe. But maybe, you know, that the ingredients are there certainly for them to have been a major player in industrial development if they had held on, as you say.
And to build an alternative to British-led slave capitalism, which ends up dominating the entire global order. I mean, Napoleon would have to make abolishing slavery like a key to his strategy in America, because that's his force multiplier. It's his ace in the hole. And that's why I honestly imagine, like, in the weak state that the United States was in at that early era, largely being because it was held back from development by these aristocratic interventions in this constitutional system, by this like slavocracy that at that point is really just presiding over a nascent social, like a political economy south of the Mason-Dixon. And if, you know, a Toussaint-led army marches in through Louisiana, promising freedom to every slave that they encounter, I can honestly see them rolling up through basically the entire slave south and turning the United States into just its trade and industry-based northern half, and then creating this, I think, inevitable then, a Federalist English alliance against this threat to Anglo-Dominion. And then you get, instead of like the quasi-war we get with France during John Adams' administration, an actual land war with France over this question throughout. It would be around the same time.
And it's a little frightening to think what that might have done to, I mean, that certainly would have had an effect on, you know, what would the reaction to that have been in America, not only in terms of military and diplomatic response, but what effect would that have had on American society? I mean, I hate to say it, but you could really easily imagine, you know, with the idea of this, you know, kind of black boogeyman figure taking over the South. I mean, does the rump America become like, you know, a proto Third Reich white supremacist state that it's, you know, devoted to the destruction of the black race? I mean, it's ugly to think about, but we've seen that fear of the other is a huge factor in American history as it exists now. You know, imagine if there had been a real existential threat coming from that other at the very beginning of the country's history. It's, you know, not pleasant to think what that would have done to people's outlooks and views.
But, you know, at the same time, in that fight, I honestly think there's a good chance that the French forces win. And if that happens, then maybe you have, you know, broken the back of this social formation that was going to destroy the world, or at the very least, create a context where you have this this rabid dog settler capitalism trying to fight for its life in this context against this new, you know, global trade order that is turning into capitalism, but turning into capitalism as Marx imagined it going, you know, creating a unified social whole that responds as citizens, you know, people who imagine themselves part of some abstract community, coming into counter with capitalism and being alienated along class lines, coming into class consciousness and then expressing themselves politically through that class consciousness, and get the internal road to socialism through capitalism that Marx theorized occurring in the moment of its birth, you know, when he was there for it. I mean, he was wrong, but how could he know otherwise? He lived in Europe. He didn't realize that the real structures that were going to dominate and define what it means to be a member of a class, what it means to be a citizen of a country, was being done in the New World, in the United States, most specifically.
Let's talk about Napoleon for a second in this world. Does Napoleon, now that he has this Caribbean empire to really protect, that's also part of this ideological project, and he's going into the southeastern United States and, let's say, even marching north and facing some Federalist future Confederate foe at some point. What happens in Europe? Does he still go east? Does he still try to invade Moscow? Because I imagine the supply logistics would make that virtually impossible. So you don't have a Waterloo. You don't have an expansion eastward. Is that correct? It's more of a focus on the Western Hemisphere than what we actually wound up having, which was the French attempt to basically create a continental European empire.
Can't do it. Can't do a continental European empire.
And the other thing, you know, Napoleon was not ideologically committed to a war with Russia. His vision always was basically France and Russia dividing Europe between them. And he invaded Russia because they were not adhering to the continental system, which was his sort of economic blockade, economic war, you could almost say, on Great Britain. But with this imagined French colonial empire in the New World, I'm not sure he has the same need to wage economic war on Britain in the way he did with the continental system. And so I think in that circumstance, the rationale for the invasion of Russia kind of evaporates. And Franco-Russian relations are probably much better. The French are much more likely to say, you know, okay, if you've got to do a little bit of trade with the Brits, you know, for your economy, you know, whatever, let's focus on the big issue, which is how we're going to divide up the continent between us. You know, where's the line in Poland or Belarus or whatever, where our influences, you know, trade off. And so, you know, I think that could have averted almost certainly the biggest mistake of Napoleon's career. So, you know, I think it's so much of, especially the latter half of the Napoleonic Wars, are about these economic issues. And so without with the economic picture totally different, you don't see things play out the same way.
You basically get capitalism with French characteristics, which would be a more artisanal, capitalism, a capitalism focused more on guilds and things along those lines, which is very different from the hyper steroidal industrial capitalism of Britain. So you also have the creation of a different order. And guys, I have a question for you. In this world, is Napoleon, because he's not expanding too much eastward for economic reasons, is he able to keep the German principalities effectively pacified, therefore preventing a unified German nationalism from emerging?
I think German nationalism was already emerging. I mean, I think the moment that the French walked into Germany, that was kind of an inevitability. But the question is, you know, where and how does that find expression? You know, because there are circumstances, you know, there was a lot of pan-Latin American feeling after the Latin American Wars of Independence, and nothing ever came of it. So, you know, it's a question, you know, how does that find expression if there's no kind of political military route to a German nation? There's also the question of, you know, there's at this point, by the latter half of the Napoleonic Wars, there's millions of Germans who are citizens of France. And so do they maintain their German identities? Do they continue speaking German, but maybe have a French identity as well, like people in Alsace, in our universe? Or do they fully assimilate and become just French people who are all, you know, have names like Christman or whatever? And you know, so that's an open question, I would say. But it would be very interesting. And probably, I would imagine, if Napoleon had somehow won the Napoleonic Wars, the German question would have been a significant factor in European affairs in kind of the next generation.
Absolutely, in ways that we can't even really imagine, because the context is going to be so different. But yeah, he's going to have to manage, because Germany is always the problem, right, of Europe.
Napoleon said, if the Holy Roman Empire did not exist, France would have to invent it to keep the Germans weak. And he tried to invent his own version of it. So maybe that would have worked. Who knows?
Yeah.
And you could also imagine, particularly beginning in the middle of the 19th century, as racial thinking becomes more and more prominent, or maybe it doesn't in this world, but a kind of a neo-Carolingian empire. You know, you have a new form of European nationalism that's not organized around particularities, but is organized around like a Charlemagne, an imagined image of the Gauls coming back together. And then you get a totally different form of German nationalism. And here's the question, what happens to our boy Marx? Does Marx not go to Jena? Does he go to the Sorbonne? And is Marx now a theorist of, instead of industrial Anglo-German capitalism, which is really what he was from Germany writing in the UK, does he develop an entire new theory of capitalism based on, again, capitalism with French characteristics?
I mean, you know, Marx was from the Rhineland. He was from an area that was a part of, you know, Napoleon's empire. And, you know, his background, you know, coming from a converted Jewish family, his father was a minor technocrat. That's like, you know, if you were trying to come up with a theoretical person who would support French rule in Germany, that's exactly the profile of person that you would. So yeah, my guess would be that, you know, who knows, maybe his family goes Catholic instead of Protestant. And, you know, it's Charles-Marie Marx is the most famous French philosopher of the 19th century.
That's a good one. All right, guys, let's go to our next hinge point, which is probably the one that people always ask about Napoleon. And let's just bring it out there. Napoleon wins at Waterloo. What happens? Why is it important? So maybe, Everett, maybe you could just set the scene of Waterloo for people who might not be Napoleon scholars, and why that's itself a hinge point in history.
Well, this is, to me, kind of a deceptive hinge point, because if you look at sort of the broader picture and on the eve of Waterloo, Napoleon's situation looks completely hopeless. I would compare early in the Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon is sort of like, imagine a boxer who's maybe not the strongest, but is very fast and has a very good reach. So, you know, you can get the most muscly boxer in the universe to fight him, but if he can't land a blow, he's going to win. And that's sort of how Napoleon fought these wars. His enemies always had more troops, more resources. But because Napoleon had this huge empire and this very fast-moving and huge army, he's able to, when a threat emerges, he's able to swoop in and neutralize it before it really turns into an existential threat. And you see that again and again in the Napoleonic Wars. But by Waterloo, you know, he's basically restricted to France's borders as they exist today. There's enemy armies all around. And his only real hope is to sort of roll sevens every time. He's got about 175,000 men to work with. He's got well over 200,000 in Belgium with Wellington and Blücher. But he's also, and that's the force that defeats him at Waterloo. But to the south, on the Rhine, Prince Schwarzenberg has 250,000 men opposed by 25,000 French troops. So that's dangerous. The Russians have 200,000 more men coming that direction. There's men coming from northern Italy through that route. And the Spanish are mobilizing their armies to invade southern France. So the idea that Napoleon could have, you know, like I said, rolled sevens every time and defeated all of these forces with a smaller force without losing too much so that he wouldn't be able to go defeat the next one. But even if he'd done that, his enemies have reserves to draw on. And you can't say it's impossible, but even for a man like Napoleon, it's hard to imagine him being that successful, especially because by this point, the enemy armies, you know, Napoleon was very fond of saying about his enemies, "I'm going to teach them a lesson." And in a sense, he literally did, because every time he beat them, they learned from his methods. And so by 1815, on the eve of Waterloo, the armies opposing him are very good. And, you know, the bad officers have been disgraced in the field and lost their jobs, and the good officers have risen to replace them. They've copied things from the French and learned their own methods. So these armies are almost evenly matched, unlike at the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars when the French had a clear advantage. So to me, it's hard to imagine him winning. But this is an interesting question. You know, what if that final war had been bloodier? What if the British and the Prussians were not the ones to defeat Napoleon? You know, what if, one thing to keep in mind about the British, they had never faced Napoleon himself. They had always fought in the Peninsular War, which was a lower priority for the French, almost like the Western Allies in World War II. You know, people, you know, "Hey, you guys did great against the B team. Let's see how you fare against the Imperial Guard and Napoleon himself." And Waterloo was the first test of that, and they did have success. But, you know, the kind of narrative of the Napoleonic Wars would have been very different if the only time the British had actually faced, you know, the A-team of the French army they had lost, people would probably look at the Napoleonic Wars as, you know, a Austro-Russian victory more than anything else, with the British playing kind of a supporting role. And that would have had consequences for European diplomacy in the 19th century. And I think it would have had a lot of domestic consequences in Britain, because the Waterloo myth was really vital, even I think still is, a vital part of British national identity.
Yeah, Wellington sure as hell wouldn't have been PM if he'd lost at Waterloo.
Right.
And maybe the Chartist movement is able to gain more traction against the regime of victory if they were just a bunch of losers who got their asses saved by the fucking Tsar.
Right, exactly. The post-Napoleonic War period is really a bad period in Britain.
Yeah.
And I think, the country is in a certain sense held together by that sense of victory. In our world, we don't get the Great Reform Act until the 1830s. Maybe, you know, that radicalism in the late teens and 20s is much more intense, and we see something more dramatic happening in post-Napoleonic Britain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what we're really talking about then is less a Napoleon victory, but less of a Napoleon loss. And to me, as a diplomatic historian, that raises questions about the concert of Europe. What if you don't get a concert of Europe? What does that say? And I should also add that a lot of historians will, of course, argue there was no real concert of Europe. You have the Austro-Prussian War, you have the Franco-Prussian War, you have the many colonial wars of the 19th century. Crimea, of course. But so what if Napoleon is not as knocked out? What happens to European international history if Waterloo is less of a defeat, more of a, like, just a lesser loss?
You know, that if you imagine a War of the Seventh Coalition, which was the war that ended at Waterloo, being much longer and much bloodier, maybe there is not the appetite in Europe to allow the French to regain their status as a great power after those events. So maybe, you know, you have a little mini rump France that's sort of as big a player in European affairs as Spain or Portugal or something, and that, you know, obviously would have put, you know, the 19th century on a completely different trajectory, certainly in Europe, and probably, you know, in the places the French colonized, certainly as well.
Do you then see an Anglo-German rivalry that's focused less on naval warfare, which is what happens in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and more on building up armies?
Ooh, that's interesting. I'm not sure that the British really have an aversion to building up land forces on the continent. So maybe they would have sought a proxy for that. The rump French state is a British, satellite or protectorate, and that's sort of the cat's paw for the British on the continent. But I don't know. That's an interesting question. The British have always, in Europe, kind of divide and conquer has always been more of their style. Maybe you see, maybe they buddy up with the Austrians. Who knows? I think that's it's a really an open question. Just that things would have been very different if, because the way things worked out. The War of the Seventh Coalition was just kind of seen as an aberration, a weird thing that happened because Napoleon was able to break out of jail. Maybe if it had lasted a longer time, it would have, changed people's minds and forced them to look at European diplomacy in a different way.
And that question is raised to me because I think the major reason the United States in the 20th century became a world empire is because France fell so quickly to the Nazis. Because I think in the Anglo-American imagination, France is always viewed as a bulwark against Germany, which is essentially considered another industrial capitalist rival. So if you remove that bulwark a century and a half earlier, that to me almost engenders a stronger pull, a stronger impulse to colonialism, maybe also in the United States, because now Britain is even more powerful than it wound up being in the 19th century, controlling, let's say, Normandy, and you have like kind of a rump Vichy-esque French state throughout the 19th century, which is also crucial because, 19th century French thought is very critical for the development of liberalism. It has probably a tempering influence on liberalism. Benjamin Constant is the first liberal. Oh, yeah. So then liberalism itself, in a world where Napoleon loses Waterloo less, I think is on a almost totally different trajectory without that sort of, to put it bluntly, like this humanistic French liberalism that is not quite as found in the more laissez-faire version of British liberalism that winds up being instantiated in the United States. So this is going to bring us now to our final in the lightning round of Napoleon hinge points. And this one's a really interesting one. And that is, what if Napoleon had converted to Islam? And so, Matt, why don't you talk about this and really set the stage of what you're imagining and why this would be a world historical change?
When Napoleon was still just a humble general in the French army who was coming off the massive triumph of the Italian campaign, and was able to basically write his own ticket, he proposed an invasion of Egypt with the idea of cutting off England from their Indian holdings. And he had success against the Mamluk forces there and was able to install himself as essentially the viceroy of Egypt, and considered during this time, while he was trying to get some sort of hearts and minds campaign going with at least the elite there in Egyptian society, he toyed with the idea of converting to Islam and becoming Ali Pasha Napoleon, the independent Egyptian ruler, and then operate as a sovereign, stop the rat race up the chain of French politics, and decapitate and replace politics in the Near East.
Yeah, and it seems like such a fanciful idea, but it came really close to happening. I think after the Toussaint hypothetical, this one is probably the one that came closest to fruition, which is, he went to Al-Azhar, which is almost like a Sunni college of cardinals. It's the most, the most eminent collection of Islamic scholars in the Sunni world. And he sort of said, what would it take for you guys to endorse my regime? And they said, you have to convert to Islam. And he said, okay. And they said, not just you, though. It has to be the whole army and all your officers. And that was a bridge too far. So it really came close to happening. If kind of the mood had been different in that room, maybe it would have happened.
Circumcisions were going to be an issue, though.
Yeah, circumcisions.
They could have, but I think he might have been able to negotiate on that point.
He specifically mentioned circumcision and giving up wine as being too much to ask his troops to do.
Yeah.
But
if he
does
it, if he goes for it, then you still have this incredibly dynamic, powerful figure who's able to marshal forces of history like nobody else of his generation. But instead of being at the heart of European politics and colonial politics, he is instead now charged with taking possession of a peripheral nation with a much more nascent economic and military institutions. And the question becomes, how is he able to deal with those challenges, trying to now compete for power sort of from behind the eight ball relative to Europe?
Everett, let's play this out. What do you think happens?
There is kind of something I always like to look at when you're sort of indulging in these hypotheticals is, you know, what's a real life analog we can look at as the model for the hypothetical? And to me, the obvious one here is the man who after the French were defeated in Egypt, you know, it was kind of a jump ball almost. You know, would the Mamluks come back into power? Would the Ottomans assert direct control? Would the British turn it into some kind of protectorate? And the man who ultimately comes out on top is sort of, you know, not someone who looked like a candidate at the beginning of the process. This man named Muhammad Ali. He came from modern day Greece. He was, I believe, an ethnic Albanian who worked for the Ottomans. He was like a mercenary. Well, semi-mercenary, semi-soldier who worked for the Ottomans. And he ultimately comes out on top as the ruler of Egypt after, you know, the dust settles with this power struggle. And he engages in a really aggressive program of modernization, building a modern civil service, modern fleet, modern army, founding European-style educational institutions. And in a certain sense, he's kind of the founder of modern Egypt. And so you can look at, you know, I think the jumping off point, looking at what Napoleon could have done there is, you know, what did Muhammad Ali do, you know, 10, 20 years later? He actually had a lot of success and, you know, didn't quite succeed in turning Egypt into a modern country that could compete with the European countries, but he was able to do a lot. So I think any discussion of Napoleon, you know, being active in Egypt has to start with the fact that it seems like that it was actually fertile ground for the type of modernization program he probably would have tried to do.
So does this mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Napoleon is in Egypt, and instead of doing the whole Napoleonic Wars like they actually happened in history, he sets a base in Egypt and he begins a program of modernization and development as an Islamic leader there. So instead of getting the Napoleonic Wars, you have Napoleon basically stay there until the 1820s, let's say 1820, 1825, and he has a base in Egypt and he has a sort of Republican French base in France. And he didn't do the German campaigns and he didn't do the Russian campaigns. So now it's 1825, 1830. Napoleon has those two power bases. What is going on in Europe then? What is going on with Napoleon? Because I assume that his ambition, let's assume that as static and unchanged, that he still wants to basically be the world historical figure who transforms continental Europe and now the Islamic world. Maybe he fashions himself as sort of like this paragon of Islam, a kind of Cyrus figure. What, as Cyrus vis-a-vis Judaism in a sense. So what happens?
Well, I think that probably the French would have been defeated in Europe by the Allies much quicker. I actually would say that probably what happens, probably that there's no version of the French Revolution at that point that doesn't end with the general taking power. So, you know, maybe this is, you know, instead of that, you know, maybe Marshal Bernadotte is the, you know, the Napoleon figure in this universe. But none of those guys were as good as Napoleon, and none of them were as lucky as Napoleon. So, you know, maybe by 1806, 1807, 1808, there is no more revolutionary France. And maybe kind of the, you know, that sort of wiping the slate clean that Napoleon's conquests did in Europe doesn't come to pass. So maybe you get a Europe that's much less developed, you know, politically, economically, socially, and then, a rising power in the East. You know, you could maybe imagine a world in which, you know, there's the 19th century sees something close to parity between, you know, let's say Turkey, modern day Turkey, the Levant, and Egypt, you know, either from Napoleon conquering these areas or the local authorities having to copy his methods to resist him, you know, much like happened in Europe. So maybe you get a 19th century where, you know, the Ottoman Empire and Egypt are players in the same way that the European powers were players. And that, you know, maybe there's Islamic colonies, and we get to see, you know, how that sort of cultural and political and economic setup would have approached colonialism. It's another one where there's, you know, the Pandora's box is just absolutely massive, and you could see this, you know, working out any number of different ways.
And to me, the most interesting, or one of the most interesting things, is what if you get a sort of Egypt-based liberalism? Because Napoleon is the one who spreads liberalism from France to continental Europe. But what if he begins and takes those ideas seriously and begins to develop them more in the Levant than continental Europe? And so you have a totally different ideological history of Europe that it maybe is still way more monarchist than it wound up being, way more authoritarian, way more focused on that. And sort of you get the blending of a French style liberal capitalism in the Middle East as opposed to elsewhere.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, like in the early 19th century, there was this idea that, you know, the British represented laissez-faire, you know, the really hard laissez-faire version of liberalism. And then, you know, the American system is a more sort of a holistic view of capitalist development, shall we say. Maybe in this world, that's associated with Egypt. And that makes you think, you know, because, you know, once ideas get associated with certain regions, cultures, et cetera, they sort of take baggage from that. So maybe that, you know, view of the world gets to be seen as an Islamic view of the world rather than a Christian view of the world. And that could, you know, maybe in a sense, you know, be a barrier to those ideas entering the European mainstream as they did in our universe.
You also get permanent French access to the oil fields that will be discovered later, which is actually, or permanent Napoleonic aspect in this sort of liminal space polity. So you maybe would get a capitalism that is informed by the artisan-centered nature of French capitalism, but then in the you know, early 20th century, this polity finds oil, and then you get this marker of industrialization. Matt, what do you think Napoleon's conversion impact might have had, however you want to take it, in whatever direction?
Yeah, I just think about what would happen in France if you don't have a Napoleon defeat to fill that spot. Yeah, I think you definitely have a France that's defeated much more, much earlier, where you have a restoration much earlier, which, of course, only serves to bottle up a lot of social unrest and alienation that, in the world where Napoleon becomes emperor, gets vented off in his series of conquests and wars, and like a war-based state that sort of disciplines and organizes all of the discontent of this rapidly modernizing society. And in this world, if you're just getting a succession of these attempts to affirm a monarchical center, you know, at the behest of a European like dynastic houses that have a vested interest in preventing those evil spirits from getting loose in the world again, then I think you still end up having to have some sort of maybe early ignition of a great power conflagration, sort of defining all of 19th century politics.
So let's go to our actual final hinge points, and this is: what if Napoleon invaded England? The year is 1804, and Napoleon turns west. What happens, Everett? Describe the scene.
So, around this time, Napoleon famously said, "Give me mastery over the Channel for 6 hours, and I'll be master of the world." And so he believed that literally that was all it would take, would be the home fleet's absence from the English Channel for 6 hours would be all that would be enough. And you look at what forces the British had to oppose him at that time. They were trying to build a big canal across southern England to basically just, like, you know, section off that part of the country. So if the French overran it, they could defend. But the guys they hired to do it were crooks. And so it was, like, nowhere near done at that point. They had, like, 8 miles done. They were trying to build these fortresses along the coast, and those weren't out of snuff either. they had under 100,000 British regulars on the island. And they had a huge number of these militia forces, but they were a mess. They were not well trained. A lot of them didn't even have firearms. They were armed with pikes. This was like a big scandal in Parliament when it came out that, you know, that we've been raising all these militia forces. We're safe. Don't worry about it. And then it came out that, oh yeah, these guys don't even have guns.
Yeah. How'd they go for the crappies at Vinegar Hill? Pikes don't really work too much in this era.
Right. And you know, even if they did have guns, you know, the track record in the early phase of the Napoleonic Wars, the track record of old regime armies against the kind of reformed, you know, built back better French army is just abysmal, especially when you've got like the British army, they're totally untested. They don't know how to cope with this. And the terrain is not defensible in southern England. You know, the green and pleasant land, as the song says. And so, I mean, it's hard to imagine the British resisting in any really serious way. I mean, I think that would have been a laugher, as they say in British soccer. I mean, it would have been, you know, the Grande Armée just sweeping up the country. It's, you know, the British were really right to focus so much of their security on the Navy, because the chances of holding off the French on the land once they landed was just... I mean, again, there's just no way to picture it, really.
So they take out England. How does that affect world history? We have Napoleonic England, Napoleonic France united into one power base. The dream of the 14th century accomplished. What goes next?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to imagine the French being defeated after that. You know, this is before Austerlitz. This is before Jena-Auerstedt. So... this is when Napoleon is Napoleon and his army are at the height of their powers. And without British assistance, it's hard to, I mean, look at how poorly the great powers did against him with British assistance in the coming 2 years. So imagine without that, how badly they would have, you know, just, you know, been destroyed. And then you're left with a world where, you know, everyone west of modern-day Poland basically is under French domination. Very easy to imagine Napoleon cutting a deal with the Russians. As I mentioned earlier, that had always been his goal to, you know, let's find the line where my stuff separates from your stuff and then call it a day and be friends. And, you know, without the British complicating things, I mean, it did happen in our universe, just with the complication of the Russians having this relationship with Britain, which ultimately resulted in the agreement being destroyed. There wouldn't be that pressure in this world. So I think, you know, they sign Russia and France, sign some version of the Treaty of Tilsit, as they did in our world. And that sets the stage for the next, you know, period of European history, with Western Europe under French domination and, you know, Eastern Europe under the control of the Tsar. And that's that.
And that brings us back then to an inevitable American-French conflict, right?
Right.
That were to occur.
Yeah, because, you know, I got to imagine that a lot of those British upper class would not have accepted their country being dominated
they'd
by the French
the
and would
US.
Have left.
They'd be
yeah,
like
the U.S.,
they'd be
Canada,
like a rump
the Caribbean.
Exile. Yeah, they'd be like a rump exile elite, constantly calling for war against the French in the middle of the 19th century. Not only that, a French that maybe would have been more liberal in certain regards. So then how do you see that playing out? If like, again, Germany is basically pacified. Britain is basically pacified, though its elite flees to the dominions or former colonies and forms like an upper class there, a very powerful proto-lobbying group. What does that mean for the United States and France over the course of the 19th century? Do you get a civil war in the United States? Do you get the United States trying to do a great power conflict much earlier? Matt, what do you think?
I mean, it's easy to imagine the Civil War happening earlier. I mean, there was already a secessionist movement of New Englanders responding to the Anglo-American conflict that the Democrats focused on during their terms. It's very easy to, and we had the quasi-war under the Adams administration. It's easy to see those interests persisting and sharpening to the point where that sectional fracture point that was built into the American constitutional order gets tested much earlier and much more dramatically.
I also think actually you would see in a not dissimilar dynamic in a French-dominated Europe. I think there would still be, you know, in our universe, big sort of status quo upending wars always create kind of a reaction down the road. You know, for us, we had, you know, that we had the 60s after World War II. We had the 1848 revolutions after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And I think there would have been a similar state of affairs in a French-dominated Europe. And in our 1848, the rebels, you know, there were sort of two animating forces, the nationalism and liberalism. With a sort of liberal empire, you know, cosmopolitan and pluralistic as Napoleon's empire was, maybe the forces rising up to oppose that in the post-war, you know, unrest are nationalist and conservative. And maybe there's kind of a, almost like a proto-fascist springtime of the nations in 1848, you know, with kind of right-wing romantic German nationalists, you know, trying to topple this decadent frog empire.
That's true, but you would also have that working class, proto-socialist current that is in 1848 too. And if you have this globe, this cosmopolitan liberal empire, could you not also see the rise of a more coherent and culturally connected and autonomous socialist resistance in this same moment then?
And there is precedent for that because, you know, that is how the French revolutionaries dealt with uprisings from the right, is by empowering the left. You know, it's not impossible to imagine that maybe, you know, Napoleon III obviously would have had a very different life if his uncle had been successful. You know, maybe Napoleon III, in the moment of crisis in his version of 1848, decides he's got to arm the workers, you know, to put down the revolutionaries. That could be a very interesting counterfactual.
And to me, what's most interesting to that counterfactual is it raises the question of 1914, right? What if the workers have decades more of being integrated amongst what in our world became national spaces, but in their world are much looser? There's more freedom of movement. There's easier freedom of movement. There's novel institutions that are created. Maybe there's sorts of liberal educational institutions in Germany that didn't really exist in quite the same way. And so you get a working class that recognizes itself as such, partially because there's just more communication between a French and German working class. I mean, as you guys know, Eugen Weber's famous book From Peasants into Frenchmen, he argues that like in France, that some of these languages were not mutually intelligible. But what if you have like a mutual intelligibility in every sense of the word develop over the 19th century? I think you see a much more viable socialist movement much earlier.
Well, and you know, socialism is, I think, more amenable. I mean, obviously, no capitalists are amenable to socialism. That's kind of a silly line of argument. But the style of thinking of sort of French managed capitalism is more, you know, has more crossover with socialist thought than the pure laissez-faire Anglo-American style capitalism does. So again, it's one of those things that's such a big, broad question. It's almost hard to you know, pick one direction to take it in.
Well, it's interesting to me because it raises this fundamental issue. In our actual world, the forces of the bourgeoisie basically tilt right. What if there's a world where they like tilt left? How much would that actually change things? And they would have to tilt left to keep down the sort of romantic reactionary German nationalists that almost certainly would have arisen in the 19th century.
And, you know, there is, you know, we do see echoes of that in our world where, you know, like, for instance, if you look at like French mobilization in World War One, is very much in that kind of in that wheelhouse of sort of center left bourgeoisie defend the republic from the, you know, the barbaric, you know, Teutonic autocracy. Maybe who knows? Maybe in that world, kind of the Great Crusade is against the Russians. Maybe that détente between, you know, Napoleonic Western Europe and Russian dominated Eastern Europe breaks down, and maybe over Poland, which would be an outstanding issue in that world.
And Marx said that it would be like one thing that would have organized the working class towards self-consciousness and power would have been a war with Russia. Like he endorsed that in 1848. Like the way to get the German nation to not allow its revolutionary moment to pass was to push forward for a conflict with Russia that would have, in Marx's mind, would have pulled the German nation headlong into a socialism of necessity, basically.
In the same way that the war with Austria did in the French Revolution.
And if you could have that play out with the same social forces being unleashed.
Right.
Any final thoughts on Napoleon or hinge points with Napoleon before we call it a day?
Yeah, he's my number one pick for a guy that I look at and I'm like, man, that is the ultimate five-tool player. And I just imagine if you could just have him on your team, you know, at certain key moments, like, damn.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, you know, build your team for $20. Even if he's $15, you pick Napoleon.
You absolutely pick Napoleon.
I also just think, I mean, he's such a perfect, you know, I almost chuckled when you sent me the outline for this and there were so many topics, because normally you guys tackle like one. But that's the thing with Napoleon is that he was, I mean, like great man theory of history is discredited for very good reason. But if there ever was someone for whom it was true, it was Napoleon. He just was so good at putting himself in the key position. And so there are so many different hinge points that revolve around him because he was in a relatively, well, not relatively, extremely unusual position in world history of being able to just make decisions about things like this. And so you can picture all these, you know, situations where if he'd just gone the other way, things could have been different.
And he was unable to because, you know, none of us know what we don't know, you know? Yep. And like the one that strikes me is the one that, from the top of the episode, the most plausible alternative. If he allies with Toussaint, sends the letter. And we know that going aligning with Toussaint would have been not just in hindsight the right decision. At the time, there was plenty of evidence in front of Napoleon's face that there was no way to reimpose French rule towards the end of reimposing slavery onto Saint-Domingue. It could not be done. The British had proven it.
Yeah. Well, he sent someone to Haiti to, you know, report on this question, who told him our only shot is Toussaint. That was his own official envoy's read on the situation.
And like, so what was on the other side of the ledger? Like, yes, Josephine was the daughter of planters and they had that fucking, that lobby in his ear. But at the end of the day, it's racism. It's just he cannot take the idea of coming to some sort of agreement among equals with someone like Toussaint. It offended him at a level that warped his vision. And like that's why he's such an amazingly compelling figure, because you have in him like the full tragedy of humanity, like how you can have access to pretty much limitless gifts and the ability to recognize opportunity, but we are all shaped by forces that we can never fully comprehend and understand their impact on our decision-making and understanding of the world.
Yeah, and Napoleon had been an abolitionist in his youth. You know, it goes to show you, the man who probably arguably did the most for the cause of slavery in modern times, Napoleon Bonaparte, had been, as an idealistic young man, a committed opponent of slavery. It goes to show you that, you know, those convictions don't amount to much if you don't hold on to them when the rubber meets the road.
And on that tragic note, Everett Rummage, host of The Age of Napoleon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.